You're listening to a show called Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. I'm Mary, and tonight my guest is Brad Barr. Brad Barr is a guitarist and singer-songwriter, best known for his work with The Slip, The Barr Brothers, and Surprise Me, Mr. Davis. He's been nominated 3 times for Juno Awards and is currently living in Montreal, Quebec. Welcome to the show, Brad.
Thank you for inviting me, Mary.
Great, thanks for joining. So let's start off with a recent song of yours by the Barr Brothers, and the song is called St. Cecilia. We'll play that, and then we'll come back and we'll have a bit of a chat.
Deep.
is Saint Cecilia by the Barr Brothers. And tonight my guest is Brad Barr of the Barr Brothers. So Brad, the song we just heard is called Saint Cecilia, and you recently released this, correct, during quarantine?
Yeah, we released it around April, I think, with its companion song called Red Moth Solar Companion, actually. And the two of them came out as, I guess, sort of an A-side, B-side, if people still think of it that way. I do. Yeah, it was, we'd had those tracks sitting around since the Queens of the Breakers sessions. In fact, I think Red Moth Solar Companion was going to open the record for a while. It was supposed to be the first song, and then it's like one of those puzzles trying to make the sequence work, and then when we took it out, it's everything made sense and got easier. So so here it is now.
What does that title refer to, Red Moth Solar Companion?
It was the song, it's an instrumental song, and I don't know, it was sort of it was really just an image, but I like the thought of this sort of animal guide through a psychedelic experience, and the red moth was just the one that kept appearing to me as that song's like animal spokes creature.
Cool. Do you have any animals?
I have a cat named Michael Jackson.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your favorite era of Michael Jackson?
Oh, definitely the first couple Jackson 5 records. ABC, I Want You Back. I mean, the one that affected me the most was obviously Off the Wall and Thriller, because I was about 8 years old, and that was just the hugest thing. But yeah, the ones that I get the most enjoyment out of now are definitely the Jackson 5 stuff.
And did you cover I Want You Back before? Am I correct in remembering that?
Well, Mark Friedman, the bass player for The Slip, used to sneak that riff in the bass line, that sort of descending bass line with all those kind of substitutions. He would sneak that into jams all the time. I don't think I ever covered it sort of top to bottom, but we definitely riffed off it often.
And so you mentioned The Slip. So for those just joining, I'm speaking to Brad Barr. And Brad, we met, I looked it up in advance of this interview. We met in 2003. So that's going on 17 years ago. God, we're old.
Frontier Town, right?
Frontier Ghost Town, yeah. So you were, I remember your band played, it was the start of a run, you played a music festival called Frontier Ghost Town in Durham, Ontario, and then I think you played the Elmo Combo in Toronto, Pepper Jacks in Hamilton, and then I think maybe the Cabaret or something in Montreal, or the Swimming, I can't recall which one.
And after that, we were friends forever.
We were, definitely. I remember you were standing on, when I met you, you were standing on the roof of your van, surveying the scene.
Serving or surveying?
Both, I guess. But yeah, that was a wild place. That was, for those who've never been there, it was an old ghost town, and it was a biker compound located outside of Durham, Ontario, and a friend of mine, Mark Wilson, used to throw these legendary long weekend parties, and it was just totally homegrown, and he would invite mainly Canadian bands. I think you were one of the first, if I recall, American bands to play, and those were pretty wild times. If I recall correctly.
Yeah. I felt like there was something going on up there that I needed to know about. Like there was a scene and a but you guys also seemed completely crazy, like crazy people to me. It kind of reminded me a little of like Southern, like Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama. Like there was a lot of mud and dirt. Like the stage was just a sort of nailed together thing. There was a, I think it was like an old saloon or something behind the stage.
Yeah.
It felt kind of Wild West to me. Yeah. I mean, I guess it maybe the fact that it's called Frontier Ghost Town helped just, you know, drive that home. But it was a cool, I mean, for us, it was even sort of glamorous coming to Canada, just because it was a foreign country. We hadn't really been out of the States, I think.
Yeah, I think it was your first time.
I don't know, much.
And then you went on to play the Alma Combo, which is a famous venue in Toronto that the Rolling Stones famously played in the 70s. I believe that's when Keith Richards got arrested in Canada. And then it actually just reopened about, I'd say, a couple weeks ago. So someone bought it and spent about 4 years renovating it. And so it's now a live venue and like a recording studio as well. So
they stayed true to the sort of original design and intention. It's not like electro dance hall.
It's pretty flashy, I would say, from the photos that I've seen of it. But actually, a friend of ours, Josh Traeger from the Sam Roberts Band, he just got married there actually during quarantine. Yeah.
Oh wow. Yeah. Good for him. Good. Congratulations, Josh.
They're actually in town tonight playing a drive-in show, which is becoming more and more the norm these days in quarantine.
I remember that Alma Combo show. You've always made very, you've made sure that I know the history of where the venues that I'm at, like at the Alma Combo. I remember you filling me in on the history of the Rolling Stones. And I remember also Massey Hall. You're the one that told me about that, the concert there, Charlie Parker, Charles Mingus, Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, the quintet concert at Massey Hall before I played that. You got your, I don't know if your listeners know just what a historian you are. A scholar as well as a music fan, rock and roller.
Well, yeah, actually, so Massey Hall is currently under renovation. They've closed down for a couple of years, and part of what they did was they sold off pieces of, because they renovated all the seats, and so my sister actually bought me a seat back from Massey Hall, and it's beautifully framed, and I picked the last row of Massey Hall, so because I wanted a seat back that had absorbed all the music over the years. And actually, you played Massey Hall with Patrick Watson, correct?
Yes, and also with Spiritualized, I think. Cool. I think we did it twice. Now we're just waiting for it to get renovated. They must be nearly done with that now.
Passed there on Saturday to check it out, and it looks like they're coming along quite a bit. Like basically they have they're building like a couple of different venues, so it looks like it's coming along pretty well. So what's the biggest crowd that you've ever played for? Would it have been the Montreal Jazz Fest crowd?
That's the first one that comes to mind. that's probably it. I mean, and there was a lot of speculation. So it was a free concert, so there was no way to know how many people came. It was really... probably just based on how many people were walking by or stopping for hot dogs. If you stopped for a hot dog, you were immediately registered as having attended the show. It was probably, numbers in that, when they get that high and when crowds get that big, I have no idea what, you could tell me it was 20,000, you could tell me it was 60,000, and I really wouldn't know.
It was around 50,000.
That sounds like a good middle ground. The other concert that comes to mind was, I think it was 1999, the band Fish was doing they do these, as you know, these like huge weekend long concerts up usually in upstate New York or somewhere in New England. And we got asked to do, I think it was like their second or third one. I can't remember what it was called, the Great Went or maybe the Great Went, on an Air Force base, an abandoned Air Force base. And that was a really big crowd. I remember that being as expansive of an audience as I'd ever seen. I think it was probably around 20 or 30,000, but I don't think anyone of those attending remembered our band.
Well, I remember I went to one in upstate New York and I got a ride there. I wonder if it was the Great Went. And I remember I drove there with, I think, like, I don't know if they were like strangers. I got a ride share from Toronto. And then I walked away from the campground and then ran into friends from Montreal, Serena and those folks, and then never went back to the campsite. And by the time I went back, they'd left. So then I remember going up to Montreal and I didn't have like any luggage or anything. And I remember having to take the train back from Montreal the following day, just covered in mud, and nobody wanted to sit next to me on the train. So, that was probably around the time. No, I guess you moved to Montreal in what, 2005?
You've
been there for about, I guess 15 years. Have you picked up any of the language? Like, you speak French now?
I spoke a little French before I came here, but that not the kind, like the French obviously in Quebec is much different than the French they teach in school in Rhode Island. So, and the thing is, no one here can explain it either. Like that's been the hard part, is there's so many weird turns of phrase that when you try and slow someone down to explain what that, like, why did you just say that? Why did you do it that way? No one can tell you. They can't even really tell you what they just said either. Like, it moves quickly, but, you know, I got my Asti Tabernak, these things that, you can't say on French TV.
And so for those just joining us, I'm speaking with Brad Barr from the Barr Brothers. And so Brad, I remember it was 2017, I went to Montreal for the Leonard Cohen tribute that happened at the Museum of Contemporary Art. And it was called A Crack in Everything, and it was for Montreal's 375th anniversary celebration. And there was a multimedia exhibit that was inspired by Leonard Cohen's world and his life and his work. And I think there was 40 artists that took part, and there was over 20 kind of different exhibitions. And you were one of the people that was selected to take part in that. Could you talk a little bit about what your piece of art was for that exhibit?
Sure. If I remember correct, we did a cover of Tower of Song, and we had filmed it on a rooftop in Brooklyn because my friend Kaveh was doing the sort of audio video for those recordings. And if, it was actually a version, so I had taken his phrasing for that song, and I'd written some music around a song called I Know, I Know, I Know, which was written by Nathan Moore. So it was, I did a cover of Nathan's song using Leonard's phrasing and got this whole new song out of it. And then for this opening, I just put Leonard's words back in there, and it still worked. And it happened pretty quickly. I think the only audio they used was like what was recorded on the rooftop in Brooklyn through these little like lavalier mics. But more than our like contribution and more than the performance of that song was for me was being asked to be a part of that thing, because it's still, you know, I guess I've still felt like a bit of a newcomer in Montreal, even though I've been here for 15 years. I guess I've got this newcomer syndrome, and maybe it's because of the language or whatever it is, like, you know, wanting to I don't know. It was very affirming for me to be asked to be a part of a tribute to such a sort of grandfatherly, elder, noble person of Montreal. For me, it was kind of stunning and affirming, and I've felt less like an outsider since then.
Yeah, it was actually, I think you and I went to that exhibit together. Now that
we did. Yeah, with my son Eli. Great. Eli, I remember he really liked you. He really like wanted to follow you around. he took to you immediately.
And so yeah, he's pretty special.
Yeah. Yeah, you can hang out with him anytime.
So Leonard's obviously a poet and a musician, and lyrics, his lyrics kind of stand alone with or without music behind them. Do you have a favorite lyric that you've ever written?
I've got some, yeah, well, let's see. So I've got some that haven't made it into songs yet, some that I'm like waiting for the right song to come along to absorb it. How did that one think of an example? Let's see, how about this is one, okay, maybe I'll give it to you and maybe you can run with it and write the rest of it. Okay, let me see if I remember this. You learn how to shuffle before you learn how to deal. Learn how to covet before you learn how to steal. You learn how it breaks before you learn how it heals. Boom.
That's beautiful. I love that.
There you go. So I'm trying to find the song to fit that one into.
Cool. And how do you, like, where do you keep track of your lyrics? Like, do you have a book, a specific book, or do you just kind of write on scraps of paper, or what's your process?
I've got a bunch of books over the years, and they're all like about a third full. I'll just grab one when I'm out the door, because they're kind of scattered around my life, like around my studio, in my home, in the car. I've got probably half a dozen. They're all about the same size. They're all like, I don't know, about 1 foot, 12 inches by 8 inches. I don't like them to be much bigger than that, so I can sort of slide right down the back of my pants if I have to.
And are they lined or blank?
Blank. Yeah. I prefer ballpoint pens. You know, your average cheap Bic ballpoint pen. This might give you some insight in my songwriting process. Like the other day I finished a song that I started, I think 3 years ago, when we were in Greece. And it was just a little thing. I started the song. I think I had like the chorus idea. It was just a woman's name. And I hung on to it, and I didn't actually write anything down. I maybe had a couple voice memos of it, but I always remembered it. It's kind of stayed with me, just the vibe of it. And then about a week ago, at like 9 a.m, I was in my bed, and I wrote all the rest of the words. And that's a pretty common thing for me. A song will come, and if it's still hanging around 3 years later, then one morning I'll finish it and just write it all down. Yeah, that's it's weird. I know a lot of people say like I got to get it in the moment, and it's true. There is like a moment when you're inspired and you got to ride it out. But for me, sometimes that moment is not like at the birth of the song. Sometimes that song has to evolve and actually almost stand the test of time. Like if it's still there with me, if I can still recall, oh yeah, there was that song, and pick it up and start playing, if it still feels inspiring, then it gets finished.
And do you associate, I read an article recently about I'm not going to pronounce this right, I think it's called like synesthesia or something. I don't know if you've heard about this, and it's like
synesthesia. Yeah.
And it's like the association with color to words, I believe, if I'm.
Or any sense to another sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really interesting where I think a lot of people have it and just assume that that's how people learn. And so to find out that there's a name for it is surprising, I think. So.
Do you relate to that? Have you ever?
Yeah, I do.
Thought you'd have that? Yeah. I could imagine you'd have that. I don't know that I have that. Although keys like the key of A or the key of C, those all have color references for me. Like it's very clear to me that A is red, that E is black.
Really?
That C is yellow, G is green. Huh. Like they, you know, but.
And then you do have it.
I can also say why that is. Like G is right. Like what most you know, country bluegrass songs feel, you know, are written in. So it feels like green fields. E is the key of Born to Be Wild, which is like, you know, black motorcycle jackets. A is what most of AC/DC's first record was written in, and I don't know, it just feels red. There's that cover with the fire. So I feel like I've got kind of particular things. Oh yeah. Yeah.
Don't you have a story about an AC/DC set that you did? What's that story again? I heard about this. It was like, you remember what I'm talking about?
Well, we had an AC/DC cover band in Montreal. We did two shows in 2 years. Mm-hmm. It was called the High Voltage Review. So we just did their first record, start to finish, and would encore with Let There Be Rock and Ride On.
And who was in? Well, Ride On's such an interesting song. It kind of like, do you ever listen to like early ZZ Top?
Yeah, of course.
It's like early ZZ Top is so different from older ZZ Top, and it kind of has that like that groove to it. And then who was in that band? Who was in that?
Just to speak to that also, because maybe some listeners don't know that, you know, AC/DC had a different lead singer from 1974 to 1980, Bon Scott, who was their first lead singer. And then he died in 1980, kind of at the height, right while they were working on, right after Highway to Hell, right before Back in Black. And then it became Brian Johnson, who's been with them since, until maybe recently. And that's the era of AC/DC I listened to. I don't really listen to anything with Brian Johnson, bless his heart. He has my respect, but Bon Scott, the lead singer, just had such a sort of like this wink and a nod. There's all this character. And I think that's what maybe puts that song and that era of AC/DC like in its own realm, makes it feel like a different vibe. But to answer your question, that band was myself, Mike O'Brien, great, great guitar player here in Montreal, Eric DeGraw, who...
No way, I know Eric.
Yep, Eric, he was also the Barr Brothers tour manager for a while. He's played bass in Land of Talk. He's played bass in Plants and Animals. Just an all-around wonderful guy. He also is a great masseuse. yeah. If you're ever in Montreal and need a massage, he's very professional. And then a drummer named Mikey, who's I can't remember the last name, but really solid guy. And then our lead singer was Peter Hall, who is a Halifax native, lives in Los Angeles now, and just understood the intention behind every single word on that record. He was as big a fan as I was and as I am. And he knew how to deliver Bon Scott with a little slick little nod and a wink.
So for those just joining, I'm speaking with Brad Barr of the Barr Brothers. So Brad, you just referenced playing an AC/DC album from start to finish. Last year in Toronto and in Montreal, you did a series of shows called An Album Nightly. So it was late February, early March at the Mod Club Theatre, and you played the Barr Brothers night one, Sleeping Operator night two, and Queens of the Breakers night three. What prompted you to do that, and what was the process like, kind of leading up to it? Like how did that idea come to form?
It started as a joke, actually. We wanted to see if anyone would pick up on the fact that the title was of the series was called Anal Bum Nightly. But nobody did. And then we were stuck and had to do it anyway. It was, I guess, you know, the band had gone through quite a few changes. Sarah had left. We'd been playing with a new pedal steel player, Brett Lanier. Morgan Moore, our current bass player, he had not really played much on the first two albums. A bit on Sleeping Operator, but... So, I don't know, it's kind of this idea that it would be really cool if this band that we have now, which really is just feels so tight and so like gelled together, if this band could play the whole repertoire, if we could do that, what it would feel like to play those older tunes with this band and see if it would give them just some new gas. Like I'm not really one for it wasn't like a really nostalgic idea. It was more like, I think we can milk these songs that we put out so long ago. I think we can kind of milk them in a new way, that there's still some turf in there to explore with this band, especially with all the crazy minds that are working now. Brett's pedal steel, and his guitar playing, and Evelyn's approach to the harp. It was just kind of that. And we had kind of completed the the Queens of the Breakers tour cycle, and but still wanted to play shows. So it was a way to kind of have some new, you know, make new material out of old material, recycle it, I guess.
Yeah. So your band, the Barr Brothers, really kind of reintroduced, I would say, the harp to kind of modern music. Have you ever tried playing the harp, or did you learn it at all while you were playing, had one playing in your band?
I wouldn't say I learned it. I learned how difficult an instrument it is and how much of a masochist you have to be to decide to be a harp player. But there was a lot of time, enough times of it, you know, sitting on stage, sitting in the studio or down in our rehearsal where I would get on that thing. And I will say that, like, it's one of those instruments that you feel like you can do it right away. Like you put your hands on a harp and all of a sudden you're making music. It's not like a guitar where you've got to know, you know, where it hurts a little, push your fingers down, and it takes some knowledge of just the coordination. The harp, like, just to get some basic sounds going is really easy, but to actually do anything challenging on it is so beyond me. Like, especially when you consider that. So the harp has, the grand pedal harp has, seven pedals at the feet of the harpist. Each one of those pedals moves a set of strings up a pitch or down a pitch or in the middle. So there's three options for each one of those pedals. If you watch the great harp players, very, you know, skilled harp players, their feet are moving and these pedals around, changing keys, and it's insane. Because just to concentrate on your fingers is one thing.
Right.
To know where to, which pedals to move in which directions, it's like, I don't know what to compare it to. Like,
it's like rubbing your seven, yeah, tapping your head at the same time.
if you had like eight arms and had to like also, you know, pick your nose and scratch your bum too, and do it would drive me crazy.
And how sensitive is the harp to temperature? Like, did that come into play on your tours? Like, is it quite sensitive?
It never stayed in the car. It always came in. I don't know if it's more sensitive than a guitar. I think it's a little thicker than a guitar, actually. I would say, like, an old guitar would probably be more sensitive because the wood is thinner. But good question. And also, like, just to be clear about this, like, we never, it was not really ever our intention to, like, start a band with a harp player. It's kind of interesting the way it happened, you know, meeting Sarah. Sarah was my neighbor, and we all, you know, we would play these little songs together, right after I'd moved to Montreal, writing a lot of these little sort of classical Baroque / folk songs that I'd learned with Sarah. But it didn't really click until, I think Andrew was the one that proposed it, him being a fan of, there was a band called Wakachi who was from Brazil, and they combined a lot of these Brazilian folk ideas with classical instruments. They worked with Philip Glass, and Andrew was really into that record at the time. I think he sort of had that vision. I always thought, that's insane. You don't want to get in a band with a harp player. How are we even going to move it around? But we figured it out. It was a big learning process, but we figured it out.
Nice.
Or at least, you know, learned a lot. I don't know if we ever figured it out. We figured out how to rent a harp in every city we needed to fly into. And we figured out how to, or the harpist you know, Sarah and Evelyn put a lot of time into thinking about how to just amplify a harp. You know, it was always a big question. There are electric harps, but Sarah didn't have an electric harp. We had to do all these, she came up with these pickup systems that were really elaborate.
So for those just joining, you're listening to a show called Dangerfield on 101.5 FM, The Hawk out of Hamilton. I'm Mary, and my guest tonight is Brad Barr. So Brad, on September 20th, so just a little over a week ago, a documentary came out called Fear of Dancing. It's described as an original film chronicling director Michael Alcock's global quest to understand why he and so many others on this planet are terrified by the simple act of dancing. So I was alerted to this because my dad watched the documentary and then sent me a text saying, Mary, the Barr Brothers did the original music for this documentary. And he messaged me.
Yeah.
How do I not even know this, Dad? You're ahead of the curve. Can you talk a little about how that came to be and kind of what the process was like for scoring a film?
Yeah, sure. Michael came to us, I want to say around October, November last year, told us he was making a movie, told us it was about the fear of dancing, or it's also known clinically as chorophobia. And he was at our show, I think at the Danforth, and it was that song, a song of ours, You Would Have to Lose Your Mind. And he said that the reason he picked us was because essentially he was about halfway through making the film and he'd visited doctors, and that's kind of, he said, that's basically what this doctor told me in so many words: you would have to lose your mind. You'd have to like get so far out of your critical self to dance. And he said it just sort of clicked. It married us to the film for him. And we haven't done that much scoring of films, so we were up for the challenge. It was cool. A lot of it was just making fun, groovy tracks. There was a lot of sort of reference music they had. Mm-hmm. And I'd say about half of it was like us really getting to explore some stuff like artistically, and half of it was us just trying to make, you know, something sound like Paul's Boutique.
Was the film edited completely before you did the music to it, or were you part of the process of, like, were you in the editing process as well?
It was not final edited, but it was, I'm going to say it was about, I think they'd shot it all, and we were seeing like a mostly edited, the 75% their edited version. We'd look at the scene and they'd say, I don't know, we want something, you know, kind of dreamy on this scene, something, and occasionally they have a reference music, which I would think worked or didn't work, and we just try something. And they were pretty accepting of most of the stuff we sent. There was a couple things. The opening song was very hard. They wanted, a lot of it was kind of rearranging and adapting that song, You Would Have to Lose Your Mind, like coming up with alternative ways to play it. Like we did it on marimba, we did it on piano, we did it on banjo, tried mixing those together, different tempos. It was cool. I mean, I really will only take gigs like that when there's a certain amount of freedom in it, and And I felt like that this one allowed us to, and we just had fun too. I love making funk tracks.
Right.
It's a muscle that I don't flex that often in the Barr Brothers, but it's something like, you know, coming up as a musician in Boston, we played a lot of funk gigs. Right. You know, it sounds stupid now, but it's true. It's something that we like honed, the art of being groovy. It was like, you know, it was important to us in Boston at the time to be able to call upon the funk.
And do you have a favorite funk song?
Do I have a favorite funk song? I would say my favorite going funk album is probably Maggot Brain by Funkadelic.
Nice.
Either that or I like some funky Ike Turner stuff, like the what's that tune? Getting Nasty. And then you really can't beat James Brown. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. I mean, the way that a guitar, they're just so classy. Like a guitar is not just, and that's where a lot of people miss the point. Like, you know, you think funk, it's like a guitar that's just constantly waka, waka, waka. But like, you listen to James Brown, it's like there's horns, bass, and drums, and the guitar will maybe have one little jab on beat four of the measure, and like so refined and well arranged.
And do you have a favorite music related movie? So whether it's like a music documentary or a film that kind of revolves around music?
I don't know if it's my favorite, but this is the one that comes to mind. It's worth seeing. It's great. It's a movie called Lachodrome, Latcho, second word drome, Drom.
Okay.
And it's there's no actual narrative or a concrete storyline, but it just follows the path of the you know, Roma gypsy music from its origins in near India and I guess Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, as it traveled into, you know, and through Russia, of course, in Eastern Europe, into Europe, where, you know, it became, where Eastern Europe and Romania, where it's the, you know, currently the torch is being carried by like Tarif de Heydukes, and then into France, where it was the hot jazz, you know, with Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli, and then into Spain, the flamenco music. It follows that path of that music with so much just vibrant characters and people performing this and traditions, and, you know, doing it for really, really just to have this, they needed that outlet. There was so much suffering and persecution over the years, and you just see it in their faces, and very cool movie. And it's also where I learned about the pulling on the string trick on the guitar, where you tie a little string on. That's the first place I saw that done by a violinist from Tarif de Heydukes. So
yeah, because you tend to do that in most shows, right?
I've always got a string tied on there.
Yeah, and it's almost like, is that kind of like theremin-esque, like that, or is it?
It looks like that because you can't. Yeah. The string is so thin. It's just a little piece of. For those that have never seen it, which probably most of you, it's like a prepared guitar technique where you tie a piece of polyester sewing thread onto one of the strings of your guitar, and it just dangles like an arm's length piece of thread. It just dangles down, and then when you pick it up and slide your fingers along it, it acts as like a resonator, as a textured vibration that transfers on the guitar string. But it looks, if you're in the audience, it looks like I'm just, you know, gesturing pretentiously in the air, trying to do some hocus pocus, like a theremin looking thing. But that's just because you can't see the little thread there.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty special. So when you talk about kind of world music, how much of like an instrument purchaser are you? So for example, like when you travel, are you the type of person that loves buying instruments, or do you prefer to kind of have your core group? So like, and then when you're traveling, do you find that you pick up instruments along your travels?
I do always like to, if I can afford it and there's something I can easily bring back, I will almost always try and bring an instrument back. yeah, in fact, the instrument I've been playing the most these days is this little four string, called a requinto from Mexico. It's like a Mexican guitar, four strings, like kind of looks like a ukulele, which I bought down there, off a great musician, great guitar maker. I bought a Gimbri in Morocco, which is like a three string bass, a very kind of early meaning, like I think this instrument is thousands of years old, from Morocco. Andrew as well. I remember Andrew went to Africa when he was 20, about 20. He came back with like 15 djembes. He had them all shipped. He's still moving them around. I don't know what. There's still, I can open this closet door here in my studio and I can see the shells of these 15 djembes. I don't know what he has in mind for them, but yeah, we do. sometimes it's a good move, sometimes it's not.
So for those just joining, you're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk. I'm Mary and I'm joined by Brad Barr tonight. So Brad, you have your own studio in Montreal.
I can send you a picture of it if you like for your show.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. And so I guess my question is, you do a lot of recording there, obviously, but then when you go to make an album, do you often go to a different studio, or can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what's your, because I think sure. You did that for, you go to some place in Quebec, yeah. The last one?
Oh, yep. Yeah, every record's been a little different, and our studio has sort of grown and grown up also over the years. Our first record, the Barr Brothers record, that was done almost entirely here in our studio, because that's all we could afford at that time. We didn't really know we were making a record either. And the studio was much more, we were in like really a tiny little room for that one. The next two records, we have opted to go to a more professional space, a more kind of something a little more set up with people that know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. In both cases, we brought in an engineer from LA, Ryan Freeland. In both cases, the last two records, we used MixArt Studios in Montreal. And then, and also for the last record, Queens of the Breakers, we went to this studio way out in the woods. Like, you need a snowmobile to get in there. And that was really cool. That was that isolating experience, like a frozen lake, nobody else, just ourselves. That was really just for the sort of fleshing out of the music, just to be able to record straight for a week, get all the ideas. Although some of the versions of those songs did did make it on the record. Queens of the Breakers, the song, the title track, is from there. You Would Have to Lose Your Mind is from that place. Look Before It Changes is from there. I think even Hideous Glorious. Yeah, a bunch of the songs we could not, like, we thought we were kind of making demos of those tunes, but we couldn't recreate that vibe of that just isolated, icy feel of a remote studio.
Studio you have now, is that you've had that the whole time you've been in Montreal, or
we have, yeah. Oh. We've had it the whole time. So every record, also, that's what we'll do, is we'll go somewhere, mostly to get, just because drum sounds are notoriously hard to get, and yeah, so, but every record we've ended up back at our studio to sort of just ring the record out here, like get the, you know, I'll do guitar parts, Andrew will do some percussion or even some piano, some vocals down here sometimes. Just kind of work it out here. Take all the stuff we did in a nice studio and bring it down to our little dungeon.
Is it underground?
It is. Well, it's a half underground. I've got, there's a couple spots with where, oh, you have a window. I can see the street right from where I am. Yeah, we're pretty cozy here, and it's become, I don't know, we've been here 13 years in this spot.
And so, for those just joining, you're listening to 101.5 FM The Hawk. My guest tonight is Brad Barr. So Brad, you're the band that I met you, that when you were in The Slip, so you met the members of that, well, you met your brother at birth, but yeah. The other member was Mark Friedman. You guys met at the Berklee School of Music. Did you meet Mark at Berklee, or did you know him in high school?
Actually, we met him in high school. We were in the high school jazz band together.
And then, so then when you went to school, you went to Berklee School of Music for a little bit. How did you find going to school for music? Like, obviously, I think you guys didn't finish. What did you love about going to school for music, and what did you not like about it?
I really loved it. As I was just sort of resigned myself to learning as much as I could. It was a great time for me. You know, I was 18, 19, or maybe 19, 20. You know, really, really hungry for that knowledge, like, you know, ready to practice 5-6 hours a day and just digest as much as I could. There were a few points where you wonder if you are hurting some side of yourself, or like betraying your, you know, that initial inspiration to just play music, the fun side of music, the rebellious side. You wonder if you're doing a disservice to that by, you know, trying to learn all these rules, learn about the way other people did it, and learn, you know, the quote, correct way to do it, or, you know, just feed it all this knowledge. But I remember thinking that if my whatever part of me, my inspiration, my, you know, natural drive to play music is resilient enough, it can sustain the hit of some knowledge. You know, if it crumbles in the face of just some, you know, wisdom of the elders, then it probably wasn't that strong to begin with. This was what I told myself. So I dove into it. I also didn't stay long enough to have to go through like the really shitty classes, like conducting, you know, which is like a prerequisite. I did not take any music business classes, which now I kind of wish I had, but yeah, I got out of there. I just took, the classes I wanted to and right. then left.
And then, and was it like, what's the kind of structure of it? So, okay. So first of all, did you take formal lessons growing up leading into that? Or was that your first foray into that?
I took piano from about the age of 6 to 10, mm-hmm. Which, you know, at the time, I don't really remember gleaning anything necessarily, but I think it really set me up for, it just got my ears tuned in, got my fingers aware of what, got the language under my tongue to what, oh, this is the key of G. It's got one black key in there. Okay. And then in high school, I took some guitar lessons here and there, but most of my education really was just playing with my brother and trying to get a band of, you know, like-minded guys to be able to get through a rendition of, you know, a Doors song or something. Like, most of the education was from playing with a drummer and then just my own curiosity, I'd say.
And what kind of music did your parents listen to when you were growing up?
Oh, well, I remember two records growing up. I remember Anne Murray, Teddy Bear's yeah. Picnic. I remember the Eagles' Greatest Hits because the cover looked so awesome. It was a skull of an eagle in blue sand or something. And then I remember thinking, oh my God, this is going to be awesome, this record. And putting it on and being like, you know, you can't hide your lying eyes. I was like, what the, this can't be the right record. It's not. I since have like, you know, I do like some Eagles songs, but my dad, then I discovered that my dad had a couple Rolling Stones records in his collection. I think it wasn't until I was about 16 that my dad told me that he had actually seen the Stones in 1964 and 1965.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was 65 and 66 while he was on tours. He was in the Coast Guard. He saw them in Chicago and he saw them maybe in New Jersey or something. And that's, he had, I know. He had 12x5 and Out of Our Heads, I think. And immediately gained way more cred around the house. But they weren't like, music wasn't a big part of their lives. You know, my dad loved Elvis, but they didn't listen to the Beatles. Mm-hmm. My dad loved the Stones. My mom was, you know, I like, yeah, her taste was, yeah, I'm going to say, she liked the schmaltzy stuff. Yeah. But that's important. You know, I think it's important. Like,
I agree.
Like to have something to rail against as a kid, to be like, I'm not listening to this crap.
Oh man. Mm. So Brad, we're coming up, getting close on an hour here.
Really?
Yeah.
That went fast.
Right?
Great to hear your voice. It's just great to hear your voice. We haven't talked like this in so long.
I know. I think that maybe, unless, do you want to play a song live right now?
Sure.
Yeah. Play us a ditty, Brian, please.
All right. A new song, maybe? Would you like to hear a new song?
Yeah, is that?
Yeah, all right. So this is,
yeah,
the sound you're hearing. This is that little Mexican guitar I was telling you about. a young coyote stumble after 3 weeks across the desert, and his heart was beating fast as he beheld the ocean for the first time. His breath was short and his eyes were lit. He thought, if there is any truth out there, this must be it. That's how I felt the first time I laid eyes on you. Mina, 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 Mina. I'm the fly on the mirror, your rum and coke stirrer. I'm the ice cube melting quickly in your glass. I'm the bead of sweat tracing your scapularies, pacing myself, placing myself in the small of your back. Mina, 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 Mina. And if the road through the forest's so dangerous, why does it feel like it was made for us? It's something sweet and awful that drives me, and I can't explain. But if I close both my windows and I hold my breath, maybe the lack of my senses will cushion my death. This thing must be contained. Do you need evidence? No, I don't need evidence. Do you challenge my eloquence? Fuck you and your eloquence. I can see my irrelevance, my experience, and over-opulence. I'm in the wild, and if the crown of the magi doesn't suit your size, and if the crows on the mesa haven't plucked out your eyes, wiser men have fallen. So why couldn't I? Mina, Mina, Mina. So I guess I'll go now. Leave the bends by the ocean. Deep the arch in charge with a mastermind potion. Why? You know, we're breaking up the bone. Breaking up the weariness. And for my last trick, I'll stick the knife through my guitar. I'll make it look like an accident. Blood drips down the wire from my lips. The name whisper, twist of fate.
Thank you. That was Brad Barr. That was awesome. I love that new
Thank
song.
You.
Good Thanks. Work.
Aww.
Cool. Aww. Okay, well, it's time to call it a night, but thank you so much, Brad. And
it's been such a pleasure, Mary. And I can't wait to be back in Toronto. Maybe maybe at Massey Hall. I don't know.
Be yes.
Good to get back in there. Good to see you anywhere.
Awesome. Take care, my dear. Bye.
You too. Bye. Bye.